Game 2 of the World Series just happened, and we were there on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. We will take you through the sort of compelling Game 2 and the absolutely historic and unforgettable Game 1, and then hold your hand and show you what's going to happen next. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world, recording from Dodger Stadium after Game 2 of the World Series. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Ron Burgundy.
No, it not Ron Burgundy. It Jordan Schusterman sitting on the concourse up in the just beyond the auxiliary press box here at Dodger Stadium. Jake is sitting in the auxiliary press box. I am up on the concourse staring at the entrance to sections 59, 57, and 55. And Jake Mintz, we just watched Game 2 of the World Series. We are going to talk about that first. Then we are going to talk about Game 1 of the World Series, which also happened here at Dodger Stadium, believe it or not. Can you believe that? They just played yesterday, and then they played another game again today. Aren't these guys tired?
Joel Embiid could never back-to-back.
He could tweet about World Series games back-to-back. Will he actually appear in back-to-back games? Who's to say? Jake Mintz, we have a lot to get to. We are going to work backwards. Obviously, since we did not get to record after the historic Freddie Freeman first ever walk-off Grand Slam in World Series history, normally that would be the thing to lead with, but we're going to go fresh, top of mind. Shohei Ohtani is maybe injured. The Dodgers are up 2-0. Let's get into Game 2 of the World Series where the Dodgers took a 2-0 lead. Jake Mintz, you take us through it.
Dodgers end up winning 4-2. We have Carlos Rodon on the mound for the Yankees. Yoshinobu Yamamoto on the mound for the Dodgers. First run of this game is a Tommy Edmonds solo shot off of Carlos Rodon on a fastball inside on Edmonds' hands. That came in the second inning. Yankees punch back almost immediately. Juan Soto, you're never going to believe this, works a deep count and then gets a fastball low and in. The only fastball he got in the at-bat off Yamamoto. And hits it out to right field for a tie game.
Let's pause on this Soto homer. You mentioned the deep count. Soto versus Yamamoto was one of the interesting, subplots of this game because Soto was not in the lineup when Yamamoto diced up the Yankees that were not the lineup we are seeing tonight. But Soto had never faced Yamamoto. And so it was going to be really interesting to see how Yamamoto attacked him, let alone a healthier, bigger, more imposing Yankees lineup than the one he faced in New York in June before he got injured, and he was great. But again, very different lineups. And in that first at-bat, while it did end with the ground out, Soto saw seven pitches. He saw the fastball. He saw the splitter. He saw the curveball. Again, he got out, but he saw a lot of pitches. And as Giancarlo Stanton said at the end of the LCS, after Soto hit his home run, he said, the more pitches he sees, the more dangerous he becomes. And, in some cases that's true for Stanton, but nobody is it more true for than Soto. And for a Yankees lineup that was swinging early and letting Yamamoto get deep into this game, Yamamoto was obviously great. Soto saw 13 pitches over those first two at-bats, and the second one ends with him pulling a fastball over the right field fence, and I called it, so that's also cool.
You did. You nailed it. Very happy and proud of you. Glad to be your friend. I want to say this about Juan Soto. What a freak, okay? Yoshinobu Yamamoto is such a unique look. Hitters are kind of downloading information from every pitch they've ever seen. Whenever they're seeing a pitcher, they're like, how does this fit into what I know and what I have experienced? Yamamoto does not really fit into that as far as like the release point on the fastball, how short he is, the splitter being his number one secondary. And so Soto just was like, okay, seven pitches. I think I got this. Couple more in the second at bat. Upload complete. Done
exactly.
Buffering.
Exactly.
Press home run.
And the second at bat was interesting too. So much of that at bat against Gattis for them to the homer to win the game in the CS was he's just waiting to get the fastball, waiting to get the fastball. And in that second at bat, he takes a called strike for a splitter. He swings and misses at a splitter. He fouls off a slider. And for whatever reason, Yamamoto goes back to the fastball, and he don't miss, okay? This guy don't miss.
Yamamoto did miss. That pitch was supposed to be on the outer half. It leaks inside. Soto gets to it. Tie ball game. Let's go ahead to the bottom of the third where the wheels fall off the train for our friend Carlos Rodon. Carlos gets the first two outs of the third, allows a two-out single to Mookie Betts. I go to the bathroom. theme in this postseason. Teoscar Hernandez on a 1-0 fastball up and away, 98 miles an hour, the fastest pitch of the evening for Carlos. Hernandez takes it the other way, up and out, over the fence to right for a two-run home run. Dodgers up a run. Next batter, Freddie Freeman, the hero from game one. Full count, fastball inside and up. The pitch that Nestor Cortez was trying to throw, spoilers, Freeman gets his hands into it, hits it out, 4-1 Dodgers. Rodon allows a double to Tommy Edman and an absolute seed to Kike Hernandez to end the inning. Comes back out for the fourth, gets Muncy. Aaron Boone comes out and pulls him. And then from there, the game kind of just went into cruise control.
Yeah.
Really until the ninth.
Yeah, because the Yankees relievers, I mean, let's give them some credit here. Cousins comes in. He allows a hit that makes him have to face Ohtani. And we're like, why the hell is he facing Ohtani? Why are they pitching to Ohtani? He gets him to ground out on the first pitch. Tim Hill looks great. He'll be a topic later. Clay Holmes, hitless. You know, he gets 4 outs. And then Mark Leiter Jr. with a scoreless inning too. And then back to Yamamoto. Besides Soto, man, he was just dicing him up. And while the strikeout total wasn't necessarily there, he was just fully in command. That Soto home run was the only hit he allowed over 6 1/3 innings. And he was efficient, right? So much of this Yamamoto mystery is not just that he had been injured for a long time, but because of that, we hadn't seen him go deep into games. And whether some of that was because of his performance, some of that was because of they were obviously trying to be careful with him. But the Yankees were just swinging so early and doing nothing that allowed him to pitch all the way into the seventh inning. He finishes with 86 pitches, and he was, again, only 4 strikeouts, but he was really, really, really impressive.
You're right about Yamamoto. Like, in a way, we forget the expectations that were around this guy. I mean, 25 years old, signed the single largest free agent contract ever signed by a pitcher. 12 years, $326 million, okay? And because he had injuries and missed time, and Ohtani was just changing the way we thought about baseball all season, and every other Dodger pitcher was getting hurt, you almost like forgot about, not forgot yeah. about him, but like, this guy was supposed to change the world,
yeah.
right? Like, the most money a pitcher has ever gotten. And so for him to go out here and deliver, this is what they paid for.
Yeah. And again, he just hasn't, because of the injuries and the timing and all the other things going on with the Dodgers, he hasn't been a main character. But when we previewed the series, I said he needs to be a main character because not only is he important for the Dodgers' chances of winning, but like he still has the potential to deliver a performance like this. And it was really, really, really cool. So Yamamoto was awesome. Jake, we can't skip all the way to the ninth inning because something happened in the seventh inning. Now, do you want to cover that at the end or do you want to fly through the rest of the game?
I want to cover that at the end. For those of you who live in a cave, Ohtani is maybe hurt. We'll talk about that.
Yes. Later. Okay, fine. So that happens before the ninth, but we'll get back to that. So let's go to the ninth.
Blake Treinen is the Dodgers' best reliever, or at least they consider him to be this. He comes in the ninth inning, clean ninth, and the Yankees press the time to focus button. They turn the switch. And Juan Soto singles, Aaron Judge strikes out. And you're like,
hold on. Single. This is a rocket that goes over the head of Mookie Betts and off of the wall that was hit so hard that Soto was like, all right, fine, I'll take my single.
Judge strikes out again. We promise we'll talk about him. Stanton single, Jazz single. We got a run. We got a ball game. The Yankees are threatening. Treinen hits Anthony Rizzo with a pitch, and we've got bases loaded, one out. Tying run on second, and you can feel the tension in this park. People getting quiet, like they had just been cruising for this entire game. The Yankees lineup had looked so hapless and helpless. And they just, Anthony Volpe, who had some good at-bats tonight, like he had some balls really hard tonight, takes a full count, works it deep, and strikes out swinging on a slider outside the zone. Excuse me, 2-2 count. Swings and misses, chases a slider for the huge second out for Blake Treinen.
Yeah, absolutely massive. And yeah, Volpe, you know, the production has been kind of inconsistent, but I agree. Boone's talked about it. He has looked so much better, so much more consistent over the course of this postseason. But that was obviously a tough strike out there. And that goes to 2 outs. And now you have an interesting situation. Now, at this point, Treinen's pitch count is climbing. And, you know, the Dodgers have other relievers that they clearly are comfortable to go to. And you thought with Rizzo and Jazz, maybe they would have gone to Vesia, but Trinan is still your guy and he's going to still go. But at this point, the pitch count is so high. You have Austin Wells coming up, the left-handed hitting catcher, who obviously has not been doing a lot of hitting, but he is a left-handed hitter. And so they go get Alex Vesia for Austin Wells. They counter with Jose Trevino, the right-hander. And Vesia's first pitch is a fastball that he locates pretty well. But Trevino does put a good swing on it. I wouldn't say it scared too many people. I mean, 95 off the bat. The projected distance was 345 feet. Edmund ranges back, but it's a fairly comfortable catch. And the Dodgers escape with a 4-2 victory.
Fascinating ballgame. Really interesting ballgame. I want to wrap up Rodon quickly. So in game two of the ALDS, Carlos was bad. And it happened in a very interesting way where the Royals hit a solo home run off of him kind of in the fourth inning, and he falls apart. He loses control of his emotions, and the game spirals out of control on him. Tonight was kind of different. Like, his heater was really good. He was throwing 1.2 miles an hour harder with that pitch than he averaged during the regular season. He was throwing it to the right spot. He got behind in those four key at-bats, the three home runs and the single to Betts. And what happens there is because he's not showing command of the secondary stuff, whether that's the slider, whether that's the change, whether that's even the cutter, Dodger hitters are just sitting on the fastball. Rodon's fastball is special. It's not impenetrable. And so you saw these guys just waiting for the fastball. And even though Rodon throws it to the spots, it doesn't matter because the Dodgers, respectfully, are better than the Guardians and the Royals. And so they're able to do immense damage with those pitches. Now, a big critique of Carlos all year, right, is that he threw the fastball and the slider 75% of the time. Being a two-pitch pitcher in the major leagues as a starter is really difficult. Some guys do it. It shrinks your margin for error. And on a day like today where he didn't have the slider and you just have to rely on the fastball, it makes you really one-dimensional. It makes you really predictable. And the Dodgers showed the downside of that. I think that it is, to me, it's indicative that like adding another pitch that he has real confidence over and conviction over is really important for him. I know we tried to add the cutter in spring training. He used it sparingly. He only threw, I think, two tonight. It's just when he doesn't have the breaker, you get beat.
Yeah. The changeup had been a pitch that had really helped him. He only threw six tonight. I don't know what the comfort level was there or if that just wasn't a great matchup for the Dodgers hitters. But, I mean, yeah, that's the takeaway. Again, this Dodgers lineup is just relentless. And, you know, Carlos has been homer prone this season, but this is only the third time he allowed three home runs in a game. And that is where, when you look at the box score, that is tough to come back from. Is it the reason they lost? No, because the offense, besides Juan Soto, was atrocious. You know, for eight innings. And that's credit to the Dodgers pitching, but that's the reality. And we can talk about that now before we get to the very important topic of Shohei Ohtani's subluxation.
This was Carlos Rodon's third highest fastball percentage of the season, like in terms of usage. So he really leaned on that pitch heavily tonight. And it's when your fastball is really good, it is the thing that you often want to go back to because you almost think to yourself, I'd rather get beat with this. It's like Emmanuel Clase. I'd rather get beat with the cutter than get beat with the slider. But when you're going back to it so many times, you then are on the back foot. Shohei Ohtani.
Yes. So this is the other key moment of the game. It's the bottom of the seventh, and Ohtani draws a walk. And in the middle innings, the Dodgers' offense was also not really doing anything, right? When they're, you know, smashing Carlos out of the yard, we're kind of assuming that they're just going to keep scoring, but they don't. And so Ohtani, who has not been nearly as aggressive on the bases this October as he had was in the regular season, tries to spark something. And he tries to steal with two outs and Teoscar Hernandez at the plate. First pitch slider from Clay Holmes, and he takes off. And it's like, oh, cool. Ohtani's running, right? I've been wondering for the last, like, why hasn't he been running more? What's going on?
He did that at least 50 times during the regular season.
We know that. I don't know how, but 36 in a row, right, to end the regular season. But he was caught against the Mets once. And then, in this case, he gets caught again. Perfect throw from Austin Wells. Perfect tag from Glaber. And initially, you're like, you know, the crowd's like, ah, you know, like, man, like that would have been cool. And, you know, you're kind of settling. It's third out of the inning. And you're like, okay, well, still winning. Like, go back to get closer to, you know, get some more outs. We're six outs away from, you know, a 2-0 series lead. So let's focus on that. And then
it's like, you know, and then it's like, oh my God, he's still there. It's like, oh why God, is Ohtani still by second base?
Yeah. And then it's as quiet as it has been since the first pitch of the World Series. You know, I know the Stanton homer, we'll talk about that. But no, this was not something that I have really experienced in this. We've seen injuries before, but this was a moment where everything stopped. And he's on the ground, and you can tell he's holding onto his left arm. And of course, where we're up in the ox box, like, we couldn't necessarily tell exactly what had happened. Is it his wrist? Is it his arm? We see on the replay, he's basically bracing himself with his left arm as he slides in feet first, and his arm just kind of jams into the ground a little bit harder than he would have liked, as opposed to dragging it along the ground, like behind him, when you normally would see on a slide like that. And that, when you see it like that, it's like, okay, is it the wrist? Is it the shoulder? There is, you know, the broadcast, Ken Rosenthal, reports it's a shoulder. There are many people who speak Japanese who are listening on the audio on the Japanese broadcast, and you can hear Ohtani telling the trainer, reportedly in Japanese, like, my shoulder popped out. So that's what happens. But because he just hit, and because there's only, you know, a couple innings left, like, we're not going to know, and he's the DH, we're not going to know if he got pulled from the game.
That's a key here, because he doesn't come out for defense, obviously, and he's not going to hit again. And so you, like, we both kind of realize this immediately, and it's like, okay, the next step is we all need to go ask Ohtani, like, you good? Because the range of options here is like, oh, maybe he just banged it and he's going to be fine, or it's like he's done for the World Series.
Right, and that is obviously a giant range. So we both hustle down. The game ends. Of course, we have that drama in the ninth where it's like, oh my God, are the Yankees going to come back? Are they, the Dodgers going to lose and lose Ohtani? Like, there's so many thoughts going through your mind in the ninth. But eventually we go down, and, you know, we're waiting. And I go down, and I'm waiting in the tunnel for Dodgers Clubhouse, because that is where Ohtani is likely going to go. Because this didn't seem like a situation where Ohtani was going to come to the podium, right? Normally in these postseason games, the starting pitchers or the most relevant players in the game will do a post-game press conference that is in the interview room, and that's happened. And so even with what had happened there, there was not really an expectation that Ohtani was going to do that. And so the hope was, if he was going to address it, is it was going to be in the clubhouse. And so long before the last out, people are lining up outside both clubhouses to kind of get ready for that madness, because that's just what the postseason is, and it's Dodgers-Yankees, and it's more cameras than ever, and it's more media members than ever. So I'm standing in line with a bunch of people waiting. This is probably 3 minutes after the last out, right? And, you know, it's going to be a while before they open up the clubhouse, at least a little bit. And yeah, probably it would have been at least another 15 or 20 minutes before they opened the clubhouse up. And we're all standing there. And then Ohtani just walks by, and he's in street clothes. He doesn't have anything like on his arms or anything. It doesn't look like he had ice or some sort of wrap, unless maybe there was something under his shirt, but it didn't seem like he was moved. Like, he just strolled by with Will Ireton and a couple other Dodgers staff and security.
Will Ireton is the interpreter.
Yep, his interpreter. And he's, you know, smiling and walking past everybody, and everyone in line is just like, so where is he going? Because he was walking towards the direction of the interview room, but it didn't make any sense. Like, there was no way that he was going to go do that. And then it becomes apparent that he's just leaving. And so then, like, there's just like this mad scramble back towards the direction of essentially the elevator where the players exit, which, because very unique to Dodger Stadium, is directly next to, like, the home plate dugout suites where fans are regularly coming in and out of over the course of the game. And of course, because the game just ended, there are a lot of just regular fans that are just leaving right through that same hallway and elevator.
But they're not. And this is what I saw from the other side. So I went to the Yankees clubhouse, but I heard a security guard say, there's a player coming. Hold the elevator. There's a player coming. Which in that circumstance is weird, because how would a player get over there so quickly? And so as that's happening, I kind of hang back a little bit just to see what was going on. And there are these two kind of like, not like steamed glass, but like glass that you can't really see through. There's a word for that, and I'm tired. And those are the doors where like John Legend is like over there. Like these are all like the big celebs and they're holding the doors closed because they want to let Otani come through before like every rich what's its name in LA just like bonks into this guy who maybe hurt his shoulder on the way to the elevator. And so they wait, they like hold the doors and then Otani goes by. I didn't see him. Like my view was blocked, but I saw the security guard knock on those doors, like open them and just like this onrush of, you know, rich people running to the elevators behind Otani.
Right. So, but right before that, basically, by the way, I love there's a player coming through. No, there's the player coming through. I mean, this was like, it was so chaotic. So I did
Sir, Landon, Landon Knack's making his way through here. We need to clear the area.
So I did not see him get all the way to the elevator. But by the time I had got back over there, you know, it had become clear that like, you know, a couple of the reporters, of course, Chelsea Janes, our friends down there, Stephanie Apstein, Sports Illustrated, like saw him just get in the elevator, you know, I guess declined comment and just said peace, right? And then we're just like, well, now what? It's like, okay, well, that was what we all wanted to know. And so then it just becomes a game of, okay, well, you got to go ask Dave Roberts, but Dave Roberts is going to speak after Aaron Boone. So then the Dodgers clubhouse does open and there are other players leaving, right? I saw Kershaw down there with his kids and Will Smith strolls out and other players are leaving. And they're obviously all getting ready to get on a flight to go to New York tonight. But the point is, it's like, it was just such a chaotic, bizarre sequence. You know, Otani leaves. Now, fortunately, what do we have to our benefit in this situation? We have Dave Roberts, who, as we have talked about, generally tells the truth. And so while all of the Dodgers players in the clubhouse were understandably like, I don't know anything, I'm hoping for the best, like, I don't know what you want me to say, right? Totally fair. Dave Roberts was like, yeah, it's a shoulder injury. It's a subluxation, which is essentially some level of dislocation. But he said the strength tests that Otani did were encouraging. Now, does that mean they pop the shoulder back in and he's fine? Does that mean that they are still going to figure it out tomorrow when they do MRI, whatever? Like, I don't know. But the point is, Dave Roberts gave us something that we can sit on, but now everyone's going to fly to New York, including us, in a matter of hours. And at some point tomorrow, the Dodgers are having a workout in the Bronx on Sunday evening. Maybe we get more information, maybe we don't. I believe Dave Roberts also said something along the lines of he expects Otani to play in game three. That's not nothing. But this whole sequence was just, again, singular and adds to, as always, you know, it's a reminder of the mystique of Otani. And it's frustrating for sure. And I can understand a lot of the media in LA who've been dealing with it all season. It can be kind of maddening. And this is in a very important event, right? And maybe it ends up not being as important. But the whole sequence from that moment he's down to him just strolling out of the ballpark before everybody else was really something.
There's a chance that they're trying to get Otani out of there as quick as possible so that he can go do like a test on the shoulder.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And if that is the case, I don't have an issue with him skedaddling out of there.
All we can do is tell you what happened and be like, wow, that was unique. That was strange. And as with anything with Otani, it is important. So we'll leave that there. That is all the important parts of game two. Let's take a break. Anything else? I think we should take a break. Let's take a break. And when we return, yeah.
I mean, the Dodgers won the game and they're up 2-0 in the series. I guess.
Yeah, I know. Which is, well, we will talk more about as to how they got to two instead of just one. We'll be right back here. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Now let's talk about Game 1 after talking about Game 2. Which, honestly, if we didn't have as much chaos in certainly at the end of this Game 2, I would have said we have to start with the game that ended with the first walk-off Grand Slam in World Series history. But because it now already feels so long ago, we're not going to go quite beat by beat, but let's hit the highlights of this Game 1 because this was truly a classic. And while the final score is 6-3, might not read classic when you first look at it, this was just a delight. Gerrit Cole, Jack Flaherty, and a whole bunch of moments we will remember for a long time.
Cole and Flaherty are both really good, and it becomes obvious really quickly that Flaherty has the good stuff. I was pretty critical of his performance in Game 5 against the Mets. I think fairly so. He was throwing 90. He was not throwing 90 here the other night. The velo was exactly where it needed to be, and he was cruising. Dodgers take an early lead on a triple and a sac fly. Giancarlo Stanton then in the sixth inning delivers a home run that I will remember forever for the rest of my life. We're up in the left field auxiliary press box and you say something to the extent of he's going to hit one up here. And that is comical. It is impossible. We're in foul territory. However, comes pretty close.
He was like, I got you. Let me at least hit it in your direction.
Scooping, golfing a Jack Flaherty two-strike knuckle curveball that backed up on the inner half and crushes it. Gone, instant. You know, I think Joe Davis on the call said, scrapes the sky, and that's what it felt like. Because, boy, was it up there for a while. We've talked on this pod about facing Stanton. When you get ahead of him in the count and you get him swinging outside the zone and you have him at two strikes and you're like, don't throw him a hanger. Don't throw him a hanger. Jordan, don't think of a panda. And you're thinking of a panda. And that's exactly what happened to Jack Flaherty. Stanton gave the Yankees a 2-1 lead.
Yeah, and that whole sequence was just shockingly similar to what happened to Tanner Bibee in Game 5, where he, too, was cruising, and they let him face the top of the order for a third time, and Soto got on, and then they got Judge, and they're like, oh, he's going to get out of it. Oh, he's going to avoid the damage, and he's looking so good, and he's got Stanton 0-2, and he's pitching so well, and he's made all of his pitches, and you just made the wrong pitch to the worst possible guy, and Stanton did it again. So in comes Anthony Bonda to kind of get – I mean, he's been awesome. By the way, he comes in, you know, Jazz gets a single, but he strikes out Rizzo. He strikes out Verdugo. The Yankees have a 2-1 lead as we keep this game rolling.
The next moment I think we should talk about is when Gerrit Cole leaves the ballgame. So Gerrit Cole starts the seventh, allows a single to Teoscar Hernandez, and is pulled. And that means that the Yankees have to cover 9 outs to get this thing to its conclusion. Spoiler, they don't. I think there was a lot of debate last night about who the Yankees should have used in their bullpen and when. I guess you're right, Jordan. They do get 9 more outs. They don't get 12 more outs.
12 more outs. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But to your point, but listen. Hey, we're rested. We have 3 guys that we really like and really trust. And even though it's the bullpen started to show cracks against Cleveland, it was a 1-run lead. But you're still like, okay, it's still set up in seemingly decent shape.
I don't want to chalk talk all the specific decisions here. I want to fast forward to the Gleyber play. In the 8th inning, with 1 out, Ohtani is up against Tommy Kahnle, who only throws changeups. He has thrown like 52 in a row now. It's absolutely preposterous. He gets one too much strike zone, and Ohtani just smacks it off the wall and right. Curls around first, slides into second. The throw in from Soto skips about a foot and a half in front of Gleyber Torres, who aimlessly waves at it in a lackadaisical fashion. The ball careens off the pinky of Torres's glove and pops into the air and rolls towards the mound. Ohtani sees this and scoots his way to third, 90 feet free. Thank you for the gift. That also means that Ohtani is 90 feet away from scoring with 1 out. Runner on third, 1 out. That's a huge 90 feet to give away. Next batter, Mookie Betts, hits one to center. Ohtani scores, game tied. And this, to me, is, besides the Freddie Freeman walk-off, the key moment in this game, because it opens the door for all the chaos that will come later. Look, even if Gleyber bodies that ball up, is there a chance that Ohtani scores and the pitch sequencing is different and Mookie hits a single? Of course. But to give away that base in that spot on such a basic play was so bad. So bad. And if it was a player... like, Gleyber has such a long history of having these lapses of focus on the field, and this was just one in the absolute worst spot. Look, he was benched by Aaron Boone on August 2nd for not running out a ball that he thought it was a homer. It wasn't. We've seen it a million times. Since being benched, Gleyber had the best batting average on the Yankees and the third best on-base percentage, which is exactly what they need him to do, right? He has looked a little bit better, a couple base running blunders here and there. But this is the downside of Gleyber Torres, right? That he is capable of doing this. He is liable to do this. And it just was such a bad time for such a bad play. Now, he comes back up in the next half and just delivers a preposterous swing on an elevated fastball and clobbers it off the top of the wall? No, because the ball falls into the outstretched glove of a fan. And this is the most obvious fan interference call ever. Torres is given a double. I'm so happy that this isn't the story, that it wasn't ruled a home run on either the overturn or in the moment, because boy, that would have been exhausting to talk about.
Right, because thankfully it was obvious. You know, if this ball, if the fan catches the ball more so directly over the top of the fence, this would have been a mess that would have not have been fun to talk about. But it was so obviously not going to be a home run that they call it a double. Kopech intentionally walks Juan Soto, and then in comes Blake Treinen for Aaron Judge. And Aaron Judge, if we know anything about these first two games, it's not going great. And on an elevated fastball from Treinen, he hits one pretty hard, but very high. And that ends the inning and sends us to the bottom of the ninth. Luke Weaver. This keeps on cooking. 1-2-3. Boom. Let's go to the 10th. And he had gotten, you know, two outs before that, too, even though he gave up the Mookie sack fly. We go to the 10th. Treinen.
This is the Jazz inning. This is the Jazz inning.
This is the Jazz inning. Okay, so Giancarlo strikes out. Jazz lines the ball to right. Jazz steals second. They walk Soto, or they walk Rizzo intentionally because the base is open. And then Jazz just takes third. And Treinen is just too slow, and Jazz is too fast. And it's like Jazz is just going to manufacture this run. And that's exactly what happens. Volpe grounds out. The Yankees take the lead. And it's like that was the Jazz inning. This is why you get Jazz Chisholm. I know he's been so bad, but it's like he's the only guy in the Yankees that can do that in an inning. He's the only one, truly. And so like it's like, okay, all is forgiven. Jazz just debuted the lead. Three more outs.
That's all you need.
Bottom of the lineup. 7-8-9. Three more outs. We get these three outs. Don't have to worry about Ohtani. Ohtani will just be standing there on deck.
And in to close it out is Jake Cousins. Now, there was some debate from Aaron Boone. He admitted today before game two that the one regret he had about last night was maybe not going back to Weaver for his third inning. Now, Weaver, I think, was only at 19 or 20 pitches, which would have made him available. He's never done the up, down, up, down. So you understand why he went to Cousins. Cousin gets the first out on a flyout. Then he walks Gavin Lux, which is the Dodgers' first non-intentional walk of the game. That walk means Ohtani will get up again. Means he then has to deal with the top of the order, or at least somebody does. Okay?
Right.
The next batter, the nine-hole hitter, Tommy Edman, hits like a dribbler up the middle, outstretched dive from Oswaldo Cabrera, sneaks under his glove, runners on first and second, one out. And here's the decision. Out of the bullpen, to face Ohtani, comes not Tim Hill, the Yankees' crafty sidewinding lefty who has been their choice to get wrong-handed hitters out all month long, all year long. No, in comes Nestor Cortes Jr. Nestor Cortes Jr., who was a starter for these Yankees for most of the season, who got hurt the very end of the year, had not pitched yet in October, is not built up enough to be able to start a game. His role for this postseason is to get lefties out. Boone going to Cortes instead of Hill in the spot, there's an argument for it. The argument is whoever comes in has to get Ohtani and who comes after him. And if that's Hill, or I guess Nestor, that includes Mookie Betts. And you like the Nestor versus Mookie matchup more than you like the Hill versus Mookie matchup. And that difference is enough to deal with Nestor facing Shohei Ohtani. Right? That's what we're thinking about here. Ohtani kind of bloops one down the line in left field against Nestor on the first pitch. Alex Verdugo in left field makes a running play, catches it, falls into the stands, hurls the ball back into the infield from the stands, which you can't do.
You can't do that.
Not allowed. That means
not allowed. The base runners move, one base each. Runners on second and third with two outs. And up comes Mookie Betts, LOL JK. Intentionally walk him to get the platoon advantage of Freddie Freeman against Nestor Cortes Jr. Now, why did they bring in Nestor? Because of Mookie, if they just walked Mookie. Well, they only walked Mookie because the base was open. The base was only open because Alex Verdugo made an unbelievable play, fell into the stands, and threw the ball back in.
Just a wild, again, like that whole play, which happened on the first pitch. So at this point, Nestor has thrown one pitch, and you don't have to throw those four intentional balls. So up comes Freddie, and so much has happened so quickly, and Nestor is still settling into his first outing in a month, the highest leverage appearance of his life. You know, it's something he had not done before. But they still like the matchup, and I think that they thought instead of Hill was they thought that Nestor, with his stuff, which they felt like had been trending in the right direction, and he was, the velo was there as it looked like Nestor, right? That he had a better opportunity to get a strikeout, whether that was Ohtani, whether that was Betts, whether that was Freeman. But Freddie wasn't waiting around. And the pitch that Austin Wells wanted from Nestor, which seemed to be a fastball up and in, stays down. And Freddie, who earlier in the night had tripled, just obliterated this ball. And it seems like, based on the way he's talked about it and based on what we just watched and in game two, that Freddie Freeman's ankle, while still clearly hurting, is not limiting him in the same way, because this was a guy who did not have an extra base hit before that goofy triple earlier in the game. And he just could not produce that power, that loft and launch in one swing that is, you know, part of what makes Freddie Freeman so special. But he, you know, that was a fastball not only he could handle, but he could end the game and hit the first walk-off grand slam in World Series history, and also obviously prompt all of the obvious Kirk Gibson comps, having also hit a walk-off home run in game one while not really being able to walk, which was both so cool and so obvious. He hit it at the exact same time, 8:37 p.m., right, local time. Yeah, literally to the minute, so that's wild. So that's, all those comps.
Bananas, I don't right? like okay. that. I don't like that, actually.
you're freaked out by that?
It's cool. I don't like that. I don't like
okay.
that at all.
Okay, listen. The comps are both so obvious, but then it's also like the at-bat was very different. The pitcher he was facing was not – this was the opposite of Dennis Eckersley. This is Nestor Cortes Jr. having not pitched in a month, making a relief appearance in the highest of leverage in a ridiculous spot and all these things. This is not a cat-and-mouse game where, you know, Kirk Gibson – remembered, oh, he gets the scouting report. Oh, this is when he's going to throw me this backdoor slider. I'm going to be ready for it. No. This is one pitch and kaboom, game over. I'm torching this, you know, fastball into the right field seats. That's it. There are so many things that were so obviously the same, and yet it was so, so, so different and so singular. And that is what made this moment so special.
Bingo. That's why this is so cool. That's why this is so cool, because it's not just a copy, right? It is its own beautiful, unique postseason baseball moment that is just etched with a memory on top of it. Yet it is its own singular thing, because as Freddie is walking to the plate, you are thinking about Kirk Gibson. You are thinking about how Freddie Freeman's bum ankle forced him to limp through the first two rounds of these playoffs. You are thinking about how the stadium looks identical to the way it did when Kirk Gibson hit that ball. You're thinking about it being game one. I'm not thinking about it being 8:37, but maybe some people are. And yet, when Freddie hits it on the first pitch, just an immediate blow, it's his own thing. Freddie, who dealt with so much this year, with his son being sick and spending time away from the team and spending nights at the hospital and then hurting his ankle like on the last week of the season. I mean, remember, he like almost fell over scoring a run. I believe it was in the NLCS against the Mets. Like, he couldn't put significant weight on it. For him to have this moment was so freaking cool. Freddie Freeman, who, when he first got here to LA, did not want to be here. He didn't, right? Maybe.
He certainly wasn't expecting to be here.
He cried. Right? Yeah. There was that moment where like the Braves were here and he was like super emotional about it. Understandable. He spent so much time in Atlanta. It became such a big part of him. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to go back to Atlanta. And so like him ending up here that first year, he was producing, but he didn't look comfortable. He didn't look embedded in the team. It was still like a copy and paste fit. Time heals all. And Freddie is now such an enormous part of this team and this franchise in a way that I personally didn't necessarily expect. Right. And so I am just,
That is the takeaway, right? Not that Freddie hasn't been awesome. He's produced. He's been so good in the regular season. He has already been an awesome Dodger, right? But that swing is just forever, right? I mean, we'll see if the Dodgers go on and win this World Series. They're certainly in good position to do so. That is like, you are franchise legend in a way that was not a guarantee if he was just raking in the regular season for 6 years and then moved on with his life. And so now to have that is really, really something special.
he's a first name only guy now here.
That's true.
He's Freddie. You say Freddie in the LA, maybe he was already this. I'm just saying.
In Atlanta, like, I assume. Like, but no, it's true. Yeah, it's a good point.
In LA, he is now Freddie. One word. Okay. And I think, I don't know if that was necessarily the case. Now, obviously, right now, when we're talking about the current Dodgers, yeah. But in 50 years, if you're like, I was there for the Freddie homer, everyone knows what you mean. And that is so freaking cool. And I got to say, boy, do I feel humbled and blessed and to have gotten to see that with my own eyes in person. The single coolest baseball moment I have seen. Just full stop.
Yeah. Not hard to explain why. And we talked about that, you know, coming into the series, hoping that, that a series of this magnitude would deliver anything close to a moment like this. And boy, did we get lucky. All right, let's take a one quick break. And when we return, we will look ahead to game three and give you a few other quick thoughts about what we're thinking about before we get on a plane back to
and welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Before we preview game three, I want to just very big picture summarize how we got here through these first two games. The Yankees fly home tonight back to New York with a huge bag of what ifs, right? They easily could have won both these games if one play, one swing goes the other way. If Volpe puts the ball in the gap, if Trevino gets on top of it a bit more, and that's a double. There's a lot, if Glaber corrals the ball in game one, there's a lot of what ifs. But I actually think that the first two games here, despite all of those moments, are pretty simple. The Dodgers got two spectacular starts, and the Yankees didn't hit. Jack Flaherty was amazing in game one. Yamamoto was amazing in game two. And Aaron Judge looks awful. Looks terrible. Where are you at right now on Judge? I'm curious, Jordan. I want your opinion first as someone who has not spent a ton of time around him all year, who is kind of looking at this through clean eyes, and then I'll tell you where I'm at.
Yeah, I'm not going to go because of what you just said. Like, I don't want to go too hard on it. But, you know, the reality of Judge is, yes, there has been swing and miss in his game, but not to this point. And when you're striking out this much, which is now approaching, I believe, almost a 50% strikeout rate this postseason, that is untenable, even with a couple of big swings in between, because you're just too many situations where that is just, you know, listen, you're not coming here to hear us be like, you got to put the ball in play. But when these games are this close, there are a lot of situations where, especially when you can hit the ball that hard, you probably benefit from putting the ball in play. That's not like he's not trying to. I'm not saying he's going up there trying to hit a home run, but whatever's happening, he is swinging and missing and striking out too much for them to be having any hope to beat a Dodgers team, which I'll just give my big picture takeaway. The Dodgers just have too many good players that are all performing at this level. That included the starters. That includes almost the entire lineup that has already shown us something over the course of these first two games. And that was kind of how I felt going into the series and why I gave the edge to the Dodgers. And the fact that we've already seen so many of those guys have swings like that, have offensive moments like that, is why they're already, you know, in this position. But you talk about Judge and then we'll wrap up.
Part about what makes Judge Judge is his willingness to lay off pitches outside the zone. That, as we talked about with Rodon a little bit earlier, getting up in a count then makes him even more dangerous. So being disciplined early makes him dangerous late. His chase rate, the percentage of pitches that he swings out outside the strike zone during the regular season, was 18.5. In the playoffs, it is 28.1. In the World Series, in a small sample size of just two games, it is 34.8. Okay? To me, it's kind of that simple. Because he's getting in situations where he's thinking that he's having to chase. Now, he is missing more, especially in the World Series. He is just not making contact on pitches in the zone either. But I think it all kind of starts with the chase. There was a moment in game one where I saw Judge kind of do something I really hadn't seen in a long time. It gave me a bit of concern for a player whose steadiness defines him. It was the third at-bat against Flaherty. It was a 3-2 count. And Flaherty threw him a heater. and Judge just swung right through it. It's in the strike zone. It was clear that Judge was looking for a breaking ball in that spot. And if you watch the swing, he's just so late to it. And you kind of just see him cuss at himself. One four-letter F as he walks back. And now, granted, I don't want to peel that out and be like, Judge is in full panic mode because he said this, right? That's too simple. But you don't see that a lot from this guy. After the game today, said all the right things. We just got to go and do it. I think with a player like Aaron Judge, he's going to do it. He's too good for this not to turn around for him. But he's running out of time. And if the Yankees get swept or lose in five, he will be the story because he did not perform when the lights were at their brightest. Why did he not perform? Probably just the small sample size randomness that is inherent in baseball. That's not what we're going to be talking about. Yankee fans are not sitting around being like, oh, it's fine. It's small sample size. No, it will be about Aaron Judge not being able to perform in the World Series, which is both unfair to him because it is two games so far and completely understandable because he is the captain of the New York Yankees. There is no player I am more fascinated about than Judge. He could get booed in game three.
That was exactly what I was about to ask you.
If he strikes out in his first plate appearance, I think he gets booed in game three at Yankee Stadium. In the first game he's ever played in the World Series at Yankee Stadium. Yes, I do think that could happen.
The first Yankee Stadium, you know, World Series game in 15 years. Yeah.
Or he could go yard in that plate appearance and everybody in the stands would be like, I told you so.
Yeah. Long way to go in this one. It'll be Clark Schmidt against Walker Buehler in game three. And again, those present different. I guess the main thing with that is just like, you know, how different is it in the environment there? If it's colder, right? Does that help the pitchers? That obviously helped Walker Buehler against the Mets when it was cold in New York. What does that look like? Does his stuff look crisp again? Can he get through more than four innings? And then how does this, I mean, this Dodgers offense is just ridiculous. And obviously Ohtani is going to be an important part of this, and we hope he's healthy and he's still a part of this, but man, it's just like Teoscar is so good and Tommy Edman looks great and Muncy was awful tonight and it didn't matter. Like they have so many guys at this point. And this is what we've been saying for, you know, 2 months now. And that's why I just felt so good about them going into this relatively, why I ended up leaning in their direction. Long way to go, but it's really been an impressive showing for the Dodgers so far.
As a neutral, go Yankees game three. Go Yankees game three.
Judge, please hit a home run. It would be really cool.
Judge, please hit a home run. The last point I want to make before I say goodbye, as I look out at Dodger Stadium in front of me, is that if the Yankees are going to win this thing, they got to come back here, right? Not only do they got to come back here, Carlos Rodon has to come back here and pitch here, right? The road to what they want now must return to Los Angeles. And I think that that is both imposing, intimidating, and exhilarating. I should go ask if they left anything here. Ooh. Aaron Judge was like, I left my passport in my locker in LA so that I knew I'd come
had
back.
To come back. Yeah. We'll see. But Dodgers got to be feeling pretty good. But we will see what happens with Ohtani. TBD if we record before game three, unlikely. But we'll see what happens with Ohtani. And thank you all for listening. This was a little bit longer than we anticipated, but this was a treat. This was a treat. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for staying up so late and making this show possible on the East Coast. Thank you to everyone who said hi to us and that we talked to, and just, you know, people that listen to the pod, fellow members of the media or fans and people that have been very nice to us that we've seen out here in LA. It is always very humbling. So thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. Thank you again, Andrew Hartz. And we will talk to you again very soon from New York City. Bye.